Randall Thompson's Anthem, that beautiful setting of a quintessentially American poem by Robert Frost, points up, as so much of our contemplation in this service does, the reality of existential choice. Our very nation seems to face existential choice these days. On the question, it's a good question to ponder on the Sunday before the 4th of July. What does it mean to be an American? And when I ask it, I think back to my own late mother, who was the daughter of immigrants, raised during the Great Depression in a neighborhood of immigrants, mostly from Southern and Eastern Europe then, where people spoke a dozen different languages. And one story from childhood that she would often repeat involved her and her girlfriends, when they could scrape together a nickel, going to the corner store to buy an ice cream. They would share it then. "What flavors do you have?" they would ask. And the man would rattle off what sounded like a rather long list, but in a language or accent that none of them could decipher, until he would invariably end, "Plus, I have strawberry, chocolate, and vanilla." So they would settle for one of those three, half wondering, of course, what else might exist, and half suspecting that that's all he ever really had. Well, it occurs to me that for a long time, America was a bit like that. As I grew up in small towns in the Midwest, I knew that you could be Catholic or Protestant or Jewish, but that was about it. And even when I was president of our association, I remember going to a social justice event in Washington with religious leaders, all investments, for a rally to stand for children on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. When somebody asked me, looking at my garb, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, or otherwise? And I replied, "Oh, I hope you seat me with the otherwise. They sound like the best company." Struck by how the term seemed both apt and ironic. To really understand religion in a pluralistic world, says my friend Bill Vendley, requires a high IQ, which has nothing to do with your intelligence. That stands for your irony quotient. Bill should know. He bears the heavy title Secretary General of the World Conference on Religion and Peace. Once on a trip we took together to China in 1996, he asked me to guess who had written these words. "Liberals have been correct throughout history on issues of social justice, while we have been neglectful or derelict in applying the principles of our faith to establishing justice in a fallen world." Words of that right-winger, Ralph Reed, then head of the so-called Christian Coalition. "What's irony, Daddy?" my daughter once asked. "Irony, sweetheart? Well, it's when what you expected turns out to be otherwise. With you somehow wiser, too. It's when people you don't like or who aren't like you turn out to have some wisdom after all. It's when somebody you considered other teaches you something about yourself. When it takes an anti-communist president like Richard Nixon to open up our relations with China, that's irony. Or when so-called tax and spend Democrats balance the budget. Or when family values Republicans separate immigrant children from their parents. Or a Republican on the Supreme Court is the justice who writes the key opinions on LGBT rights. That's irony. And there's plenty of it. It's when left and right and bad and weak and good and strong are more complex than you'd ever thought. And so you think more as well. Well, ironically, I think it took that trip to China with Bill for me to begin to ponder how for us Americans, with all of the freedom and the pluralism that we enjoy, our purpose, our mission as a nation may center simply on this, on being otherwise, in every sense of that term. And this is especially true for Unitarian Universalists, who often feel quite othered in the religious world. Sometimes I worry that we're so religiously self-critical that we think that the world would be better off without any religion at all. But even though John Lennon imagined that, China tried it, you know. And during Mao's Cultural Revolution, every shrine, temple, mosque, church, monastery, and seminary was closed for a whole generation, so that every religious leader Bill and I met in China, Buddhist, Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, Taoist, seemed to be either nearly 80 or barely over 30. Those in between had either been barred from training or had been killed. Only 15% of the population retained any sense of religious identity or spiritual life. And while materially China was booming, with consumer spending rising 20% that year, the crime rate rose even faster. Spiritually, the country was clearly hurting. The only thing remaining of Chinese communism being its materialism. The gap between rich and poor, growing faster even than on this side of the Pacific, opening up such a moral vacuum that the Communist Party was asking religious leaders to help them push a new slogan: renounce scientific materialism, embrace spiritual civilization. How do you like that for irony? Of course, the spiritual civilization meant Confucian-style top-down control of all religion. At a banquet given for us in Beijing's Great Hall of the People by the top official in charge of religion, I followed East Asian tradition by presenting some small symbolic gifts: simple pewter cups and wooden pen trays, both designed by Thomas Jefferson and purchased in the gift shop at Monticello, so I could speak about him as the author of the world's first real statute on religious freedom. While Bill spoke about religion's right role in every culture in preserving the deepest memory and the greatest spiritual wisdom that the community had managed to garner through the years. While our host replied, "You're right. We misunderstood religion and its role. Deep apologies are still necessary here." Bill and I then went on to a Congress of the International Association for Religious Freedom in South Korea that year, where I kept thinking how easy it is for us as Americans and as UUs to take for granted the spiritual freedom that we enjoy, with the result that we don't often realize how powerful it could be if only we would use it more deeply and more wisely in, well, just being otherwise, truly wise toward others amid all the growing diversity on this shrinking planet. For let's face it, in the generation, my own generation, the West itself has experienced a cultural revolution. The U.S., now nearly a majority-minority country, the most culturally and religiously diverse on the earth, with far more than three flavors of religion. Muslims now outnumber Episcopalians in the U.S. Hindus outnumber Presbyterians. And by the way, there are more Buddhists in the Bay Area alone than you use all across this land, which should keep us humble. But more sadly choosing none of the above, saying that religion only leads to conflict and division, forgetting as we try to witness how much more often, when not abused by demagogues, the goal of the spiritual life has been to work for communities of justice, peace, and healing. Of course, we used to come in only three flavors as well. We used to call them humanist, theist, liberal Christian. But today, our ways of deepening our own and one another's spiritual lives draw on wisdom from many more sources. Buddhist and Jewish and Muslim and Hindu and Native American and ancient forms of natural religion and awe. Surveys of religious identity in America say that nearly 750,000 people identify with Unitarian Universalism. Did you know that? But only a fourth of them support our roughly 1,000 congregations, which only proves to me that we aren't doing a good enough job of reaching out and that we need more congregations trying to be truly otherwise, because there are millions yearning to go spiritually deeper than the egocentric, individualistic consumerism of our culture, and to try to truly learn inwardly from the wisdom of others. And our way of faith, with its commitment to democracy and human rights, though it has had an influence in American history well beyond our small numbers, just like that small church in Cape Town, has not yet fully realized the catalytic power it could have in our pluralistic society by galvanizing interfaith cooperation that puts aside differences in abstract doctrine in favor of more applied forms of faith with an inclusive and civic circumference. After all, the memory that we try to keep alive is of forebears who were wise enough to put aside the creedal question, what do we all believe in common, for the more profound covenantal questions. How do we propose to treat one another and help one another? What hopes do we share that we might realize together? What promises should we try to keep to help real community around us and to deepen one another's lives in the finite time that is ours? In Jane Kenyon's powerful poem, Otherwise, which hangs in my dining room above the silver candlesticks, in her poem, wisdom comes from seeing more deeply what we take for granted and then recalling that what we most deeply share is our finitude, our human mortality. For one day, it will be otherwise. Jane wrote that poem after her husband, Donald Hall, was diagnosed with cancer. Within a year, ironically, it was she who died of leukemia. Hall survived to make it the title poem of her collected works, and he himself died just last week, at the age of 89. Morally, our lives are mortared together by our shared mortality. The words human and humane come from the same root as humus, the good earth, which bears us all and to which we all return, which we are asked to walk together in the time that is ours in humility, remembering, as Jefferson put it, that it is in our lives and not from our words that our religion is truly read. Read from how fully and wisely we have used the finite freedom that is ours. I think of my mother again. For many years before she died at 89, She could not get out of bed on two strong legs, for she had multiple sclerosis. Even confined to a wheelchair, however, she stayed engaged with others over the phone. She was volunteer coordinator for Common Cause in her state. She checked daily on other isolated elders. And before Obamacare, she once raised money for a young woman who was the religious educator in one of our congregations who'd been in a car accident with her kids and had no insurance. Ironically, just after that, my mom was also in such an accident. Dad, who was driving, just cracked a few ribs. But she lost the very last of her ability to stand, even at the kitchen sink, to help wash the dishes. And so in the rehab, where she had to spend some months with her irreversible illness, she understandably became pretty depressed and started to say, like Frankl's companions in the camp, "What's the point of going on? I can't do anything anymore. I'm a burden." Now, my brother is married to a wonderful woman named Anne, who has devoted her life to advocating for decent elder care and child care in this country. And having lost her own mother early, she'd grown very fond of ours as her very own. She also lost relatives in the Holocaust. So when I found myself talking to her about Frankl and finite freedom, she passed on to me a story that she'd heard from her rabbi. And the next time I visited Mom, I decided to tell her that far from having nothing more she could do, she still had important work. The work of being what she had always been to me and my brothers and our wives and our children, a living example of someone using finite freedom well, with the very best within her, no matter how small that freedom was. Responding to the otherness that is life itself with an ironic wisdom. And oh, she could be funny in trying to be otherwise. Which led me to the story that Anne told that I passed on to Mom and with which I'll end this morning. There was snow falling on the streets of Munich in Nazi Germany when a young woman riding on a bus home from work saw the traffic stop. Most of the passengers just got annoyed. But from where she stood toward the back of the bus, she could see into a side street where soldiers were loading people into trucks. And she began to tremble, with tears running down her cheeks. When the SS men boarded at the front to check their papers, the man next to her whispered kindly, "Whatever's the matter?" She whispered back, "I don't have the papers you have. I'm a Jew. They're going to take me." And the man paused for a moment, stepped away from her, looked her straight in the eye, and then to her horror started to scream and curse at her. "You damn stupid bitch, I can't stand to be near you." "Hey," the soldiers asked, "what's going on back there?" "Oh, hell," the man said. "My wife here has forgotten her papers again. She always does this. I'm completely fed up." And the soldiers laughed and moved on. Though she lived to tell Anne's rabbi this story, she never saw that man again, never even knew his name or what it was that in that moment prompted him to be so otherwise. My friends, Frankl was profoundly right. At every moment in life, we are questioned by life. One day it will be otherwise. We may never fully grasp or name the otherness that poses such questions to us, but that may not matter. What does matter is that while we have breath, we respond with the best that is in us, with the capacity to sustain love, with gratitude for the unmerited beauty of being itself, with other wisdom, saying no to everything that dehumanizes and makes for death, and yes to all that serves and enhances life and human community, so that in the end, our final word may still be one of thanks and praise, and so that others may be thankful for how we have lived with the finite freedom in the finite time that is ours. So may it be. Amen.